So at the end of March, three very different composers on the program, and it starts with Hindemith, which, and I always thought this was an interesting point in his career, because Hindemith had, in the 20s, been working in chamber formats, and then he started working on, to my mind, a revitalization of the concept of domestic music.
Yeah.
I remember reading that Brahms symphonies, for example, would be published in piano duet form so that people at home could play them. Yeah. And it seemed like Hindemith was writing music that was easy enough for amateur musicians to play, would not require a large orchestra. Perhaps friends could get together and play
it.
And then I suppose he changed his mind again and decided, well, perhaps now I need to focus back on the concert hall.
Yeah.
And just at that time, the Boston Symphony arrives and says, we are having a 50th anniversary concert, and we're inviting Stravinsky, Copland, Hanson, Honegger, Prokofiev, Roussel, and Hindemith to write music for the orchestra. And Hindemith was right at that point where he was writing large-scale music again.
Do you remember what year this was?
1930.
Okay.
And it is interesting that for the 50th anniversary of a large orchestra, he omits two entire sections, because he wrote the Concertmusik for brass and strings.
This is one of the few pieces this season that I have never done. And, you know, this collaborative aspect of programming that's present here is great, because it allows for people to suggest pieces that otherwise would not be considered. So this is the first time that I'm going to do this piece. It looks like a great piece to me. It actually looks like a difficult piece, in the sense that brass and strings is not a natural ally. So this is a very interesting situation. From what I've been studying of the piece, that's one of the major challenges, is that it's a piece that would be more in the repertoire of brass players than of string players. The string players know very well Matisse, der Mahler, and pieces like that, because it is part of what we learn, or what people learn in the repertoire, and it's very present in auditions, while this other piece is not. But it's a great showcase for those two sections.
Perhaps he thought that if there were any orchestra that could properly balance brass and strings, the Boston Symphony would be able to. If there were any string section capable of performing a fugue like the one he wrote, it would be the Boston Symphony.
He wrote some ferocious fugues, by the way. I mean, you know, Hindemith is, to me, one of the hidden treasures of the 20th century. There are pieces by Hindemith that are, of course, very well known and part of the repertoire, but there are some pieces, and this is one of them, that are like put aside and that are real masterpieces. Another one is a violin concerto. Hindemith has so many pieces that are never played in the symphonic repertoire. A great composer is one of the composers whom I know orchestras always enjoy seeing in the repertoire is Hindemith. He writes very well for many instruments, very idiomatically for many instruments. Of course, for the viola, he knew how to write perhaps better than anyone. Combination of academicism with romanticism, yet a different voice. Yeah? Perhaps a little bit conservative for its time, but great. Yeah.
almost as if to prove how far music can come in 100 years. Hmm. Right after the Hindemith, we go back to 1841 for the incorrectly numbered Symphony Number 4 by Robert Schumann, which, as I understand, was actually his second composed.
It's either his second or his first. But the thing is that the reason why it is his fourth is because there are two versions of this piece. And since you know so much about recordings and about things like that, there is a recording of, I believe it's Harnoncourt, doing the two versions. Mm-hmm. The original version of the fourth and the second version of the fourth.
John Elliott Gardiner did that as well on Deutsche Grammophon. The one CD with two versions, of the symphony, 1841 and 1851.
I am very happy that the second version exists, okay? The first version is fun, and it's good, and it's beautiful, but it feels like a less worked out, less concise version. One of the great things about the Fourth Symphony, it's its brevity. It's a short piece. It's a piece that's about 27, 28 minutes, yet completely satisfying and symphonic. Through composed, no break in the movement, just a very satisfying and organic piece of music. Arguably his most complete and circular piece, I would say.
He called it a symphonic fantasy originally.
Yes, correct.
And that you can, when you look at it, you can really see why he named it that.
Yes, it has a little bit of that. I mean, if you compare it to the Second Symphony, which is his Second Symphony is his big and more, it has the beautiful slow movement, it has the great ending and all that.
More what you would expect of a symphony.
What you would expect of a symphony in that time. And the Fourth doesn't really have per se a slow movement. It's a slow movement that's not so slow and it's not so romantic. Fourth is a symphony that's almost not a symphony. Also, this character of playing through composed. So this fantasy idea is very interesting. But the reason why we programmed it in this concert is because we're doing it the symphony in the first half, and it makes this first half a very satisfying yet not too long. And after intermission, there's the Brahms violin concerto. That's a meaty, long, it's one of the longest violin concertos. And I think it makes sense to do it this way. I've always liked pairing Schumann and Brahms. When we thought about, okay, we have Schumann and Brahms, who do we program with Schumann and Brahms without making it necessarily a concert of all 19th century German music? We wanted to program another German, but in the 20th century. That's why we came up with Hindemith.
Get out first Viennese school and second Viennese school.
Yes, yes. Thank you.
Well, speaking of Brahms, someone who needs no introduction, I suppose we could say, will join you for probably the most famous collaboration between Joseph Joachim and anybody.
Yeah.
Premiered on New Year's Day in 1879, the only violin concerto by Johannes Brahms, which was written, I believe, around the same time as the Symphony No. 2, and seems to have something of the happy, I guess you could call it, or sunny,
yes,
bright. Brahms seemed to be in a good mood when he wrote both both pieces. But also, he originally intended to write a concerto in four movements, but he discarded the scherzo and then wrote a completely new second movement. And that's how we ended up with the work that we have today, which is interesting because stylistically, the second movement seems to fit quite well.
Yeah, it's such a perfect piece that it's one of those that one almost does not imagine that he struggled with the form or with the melodies. It's so natural yet great, while being a very different concerto than his piano concertos. His piano concertos, you could almost put them in the category of symphonies. While the violin concerto has the length of a symphony, it's not as massive as the piano concertos. The language is more of a concertant in a continuation of Mozart and Beethoven. Brahms, you know, if you ask violinists or music lovers to list their favorite concertos, or if you wanted to do one of these surveys, I'm sure the Brahms would be at the top of, or in a short list of three or four.
Despite the fact that for the violinist, it's not particularly demanding.
You know, it is in a way, but it is. How can I say, in its...
There's no flurry of notes like in the Barber concerto.
Or the Tchaikovsky, but it is very difficult musically, very difficult intonation. It shares with the Beethoven this difficulty in its purity. So even the opening, like the opening of the Beethoven violin concerto, it's very easy for it to sound terrible. And the bar is so high, you know, you really need to, it's like the Mozart violin concerti. They're apparently not hard, theoretically, but until you play them and until you work with violinists who really can play with perfect intonation, with perfect phrasing, it's a king of a concerto. Perhaps its art is in the fact that it's so purely musical and not flashy musical. And I'm not criticizing the Tchaikovsky concerto at all. I mean, I love it and everything. But the Tchaikovsky concerto is a showpiece in the sense that the Brahms is not so much a showpiece. Even Sibelius is more showpiece. The Brahms is a purely profound musical creation. And I always think of it as a perfect partner to the Beethoven, where from the beginning, what the violin does is speak very earnestly rather than speak very virtuosically, apparently, you know.